This is Jim Fossone from VeteransRadio.net, broadcasting from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. We want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. Also, we'd like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. Until then, let's take it back to Bob Gould right here on Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Hey, here we are once again in the studio here at WAAM in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan, Talk 1600, and those of you on the internet, hello, and my partner with me, once again, we are united.
Well, we're all sitting here in a deep freeze. That's one thing we are, in a deep freeze.
You know, it makes
Welcome to Michigan, folks. This is why we live here.
Well, here we are. We have another program today. Today's program is going to be about the M1 Abrams tank. I've been wanting to do a tanker program for a long, long, long time. As we get to the M1 Abrams tank, and with me is Luke Wilson. Luke?
Walsh.
Oh, I got Patrick. Okay.
We got a Wilson
That's
in
a
here.
Movie star.
And Luke, you were a...
I was an M1A1 mechanic.
Mechanic, okay.
Absolutely.
And also with me, I'll get this one right, is Benjamin Burlow. He was the gunner. He was a gunner. Benjamin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
How you guys doing?
Hey, we're cooking here, man. Good to have you on the program. And here
Thanks
is,
for having me.
All right. And where are we calling, Ben?
What's that?
Yeah, where are you standing right now?
Oh, well, I actually just got in from shoveling snow in down in Boston, Massachusetts.
Ah, yeah, they got a little bit there, too. We'll be talking about that, and we'll talk about how those tanks fare in that kind of weather. And also, Patrick Wilson. Pat, welcome to Veterans Radio. Pat was a commander, an Abrams commander. Pat, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay, now, we got all three of these guys here. And this is going to be quite a delight. They served together in, well, Luke, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, we served together for a long time down in North Carolina. We were stationed in Camp Lejeune together. I've known Ben for, while we were in, I mean, not counting civilian time, I think I knew him in the service for probably a good two and a half years, and Patrick about the same. But we deployed all together overseas to Afghanistan doing Operation Enduring Freedom.
Which one was that? You know, I get those confused.
Enduring Freedom was making our presence known in Afghanistan and showing the people over there that it was the continuing mission to attempt to spread democracy. So,
was bin Laden dead then?
Yes. By the time we had deployed, bin Laden was killed.
Okay. All right. So, oh, boy, we're getting up to the half hour. Thank you, Nina. Thank you very much. All right, let's get with the commander. Commander, you're a commander of a crew of four. What was probably the hardest thing you had to do as commander? Tell us.
Honestly, it's to tell your gunner to go left while your driver goes right.
I had heard that in World War II, commanders put their legs. They sat on the shoulders of their driver. Is that did you still do that in your tank?
No. We don't sit on the shoulders of our drivers. Sometimes your foot might make contact with the back of their head. Sometimes.
Okay. So all right. So now you got Patton, General Patton said. He said, I don't want my tank commanders, they got to be able to see 360 degrees. You can't do that button down inside a Sherman. So that's changed. Tell us about that, Pat.
Well, it hasn't changed that much. When you actually go closed hatch, you lose 50% of your visibility, and there's not much visibility near the within like 15 meters of the actual vehicle in itself, there's not much visibility. So we generally have guys on the ground that are watching our backs. And it's kind of like a we scratch their back, they scratch our back kind of thing. Especially in urban environments, we always have infantry with us during urban environments and stuff. So, I mean, the visibility is still pretty limited.
Ben, you were one of a crew of four. Were the quarters tight?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you got your leg room and your arm room, but you kind of get sick of each other after a while.
And, well, being the gunner, did you have your own special seat? Tell us about what it's like in the inside of a tank.
Well, yes, the gunner has, everybody in there has their own seat. I'm furthest down. I'm sitting right next to the breech of the main gun. And, it's tight in there, but you get used to it after a while. Loader's on the left side of the tank. I'd say he's got the most space out of everybody. And then the TC is usually sticking his foot in the back of my head.
And you guys are all buttoned up, right?
Generally. I mean, it depends on where we are and what we're doing. If we're somewhere where we think we'll be taking some fire, then we'll be buttoned up. But
I was before I was a medic, I was a mortar gunner, I think that's what they called. They had the aiming thing. Yeah, I think they call those gunners, but we had to have proficiency. And what is your accuracy rating there, Ben? How many times did you hit your target?
Well, I mean, you're always going to hit your target.
No, I know, I know.
On the first try.
Did you always hit your target on the first try?
On the first try, no.
And so, what would you do if? I mean, here you got the bad guys. You're aiming. You fire, and it goes over or goes under. What do you do next? Obviously, you throw in another one, but are you guys talking to one another, raise the barrel or something? What are you saying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the TC and the gunner are going to be talking to each other to figure out what you have to make for a correction. The TC is going to be watching where those rounds went, and the gunner will see where the round went through the sight. So, I mean, it's all about communication, but communication's key. If you get that done, you'll hit it right after.
Right. But in the meantime, you give the other guy a chance to shoot back at you. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, if they're doing their job.
Did you feel confident when inside the 70-ton beast? Did you feel more confident? Well, okay, I got some time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're facing a couple guys with AK-47s, you're definitely going to feel confident when you're sitting behind a 120-millimeter cannon.
And it's called a smoothbore. What happened to rifling?
Well, that's actually a question you'd have to direct toward that there.
Okay. Go ahead and answer that. Why the smoothbore and not the rifling?
We don't need smoothbore because the ammunition is actually so good. It doesn't need rifling anymore, honestly. The ammo's going so fast, and there's stabilizations in the projectile in itself that rifling's just not needed.
Luke, you're shaking your head here. You got lots to say. Go ahead, tell us. What's going through your mind right now?
No, it's just outstanding the amount of knowledge that these guys, they go through all this training. They go through all this training, and then it comes out, and they just know it as second nature.
And when you were in the tank yourself, right? You had a chance to. I mean, you were working on them, and
yep.
What did you find?
As far as what?
Well, as far as conditions, as far as what the tank was all about. I mean, here's this thing. It's yours. There's four of you. That's your world.
Yep.
And no, you would have been the fifth one. There you go. Right. Yeah, you would have been the fifth one. Was there anybody else?
Go ahead.
Was there anybody else? Is that it? One mechanic?
Well, the mechanics were assigned, as far as overseas, we were assigned designated platoons, and we would get to know those tanks from top to bottom, front to back. So we knew that when a certain crew had a certain problem, we knew that that tank, oh, yeah, you know, this was acting up or that was acting up. It was a familiarity, yeah, that word, to the specific tank and that specific platoon. So like you and I were talking about briefly before, they have personalities, and you get to learn.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah.
You get to learn the personalities of each and every tank that you work on and you set your hands on. So you know that's going to act up. This is happening. Okay, we expected that. Let's handle it.
Pat, you being the commander, did you notice that there were specific personalities, entities about these tanks?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, within the crews, absolutely. I mean, it all varies, too. I mean, a lot of the leadership has a big role in how the personality kind of forms when you're doing your workup, too, prior to a deployment. And, I mean, yeah, totally. Whether if it's you can tell the hard workers from the ones that kind of slack off, you know, I mean, and that's in any job field anywhere. And, I mean, you'll see some guys, like I remember Ben, he'd be up on tanks until, like, 2 o'clock in the morning trying to, like, with mechanics, just trying to get his tank back up operating. I mean, the blood, sweat, and tears that go into that you kind of see go into a tank from the crew in itself, I think that kind of defines a personality. But yeah, totally.
Well, speaking of personalities, quite the personality that the tank was named after, which is General Creighton Abrams. And on the line with us is Robert, and he wants to comment on the Abrams tank. Robert, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Sir, I'll take you off speaker here. I've been listening on speaker. Yeah, I've called you guys before about my my book about my Vietnam experiences when I was in Vietnam in September of 1968, the day after a ground attack. General Creighton Abrams flew into our fire support base, and of course we all flew into action to stand erect with our uniforms on. All of you can remember standing at attention for a general, I assume. Yes, sir?
Well, every now and then. We got a minute. So, real quick, tell us about it real quick. What was he like? Real quick, we got 1 minute.
He was short, and he had the worst breath on any man on the planet I'd ever met. And if you want
nobody's
me to be
perfect.
Real short, I'll say this. Regardless of the performance issues of any tank, I really wish we'd had something like that in Vietnam, because my understanding is the Abrams is impenetrable to rocket-propelled grenades, and everything that we served with in Vietnam was totally vulnerable to RPGs.
And Luke, you've been sitting there very patiently. Luke is the what did they call you? Maintenance?
The mechanic.
Mechanic. Yeah,
like,
hey. I know, but everybody's a mechanic. So you were...
Well, from tankers to us, we were the mechs.
How long did you train? Well, you were always training, but initially.
Initially at Fort Knox, the job school is 3 months long.
Intense.
It wasn't bad. I learned a lot and ran a lot, actually.
Were you wrenching on vehicles before you went in the Marines?
Yes, yeah. I had a good influence from both my father and my brother. They were both in the garage. My dad was, you know, pardon my French, he was a grease monkey back in the day, and my brother's always been tinkering with cars, trucks, everything, so I kind of went in lieu of that, and I did what I knew.
What did you like best about working on the Abrams?
Let's see here.
Did you have a lot of bruised knuckles?
Yes, bruised knuckles.
Broken fingers?
No, thankfully. Thank goodness.
I mean, that's a lot of metal.
It's a lot of metal. It's a lot of hard objects. A lot of awkward angles in there, too, and very dirty conditions, usually. I don't know. There was just nothing else like it. There was nothing. I have similarities, but it was its own experience, working with hydraulics, electronics.
Yeah, you were saying, we were talking about that.
Yep.
The leveling, right?
And actually how the turret traverses.
Right, and that, tell us about that. That's hydraulics, folks.
It is hydraulics. The turret traverses.
It's oil.
And yes, and the gun elevates and depresses using pressurized oil, like the same hydraulics that you'd see in a forklift, a high-low.
Mm-hmm.
Same concept.
So conceivably, if an enemy shell fragment were to, could it cut the line, or were these lines coated with special ceramic? So, I mean, you take out a line, that's it. Or were there backups? Tell us about that.
A lot of this is all internal. The chance of those lines actually getting damaged directly by, say, shrapnel or incoming fire was not very likely. However, problems did happen from residents from, you know, unfortunately, IEDs was their primary way to hurt us in tanks. So lines could rupture.
Were they successful?
As far as IEDs go?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes it was just a graze and, you know, a bump on the head and everybody's okay. And, you know, sometimes serious damage would happen to these beasts, which it was an unfortunate situation. But we dealt with it the best we could and what we were trained to do.
Pat, tell us about IEDs.
What's that?
Tell us about IEDs, your feeling. They were diabolical.
Yeah.
What were they?
I mean, I had experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. I would say the ones in Iraq were, they were much more dangerous for tanks just because, for one, we had less armor on the tanks at that point in time, and two, they were actually made out of military-grade explosives, like old artillery shells and stuff. In Afghanistan, it was mostly like fertilizer. Depending on how big they made them, it depends on how much damage it did to our tank.
Well,
what exactly that hit.
Okay, tanks get damaged, that's for sure. And here's Luke shaking his head, as we've talked about this before. Luke was in you would go out and Pat, I think you said this. You called it prairie dogging, right?
Yeah. That is not an official term either.
No, I know, but I like that, prairie dogging. That means, folks, they weren't in mountainous terrain. They were out there in the wide open spaces. So when Luke, when you went out in service vehicles that broke down, what would be the field instead of the FOB? Is that correct?
Yes, definitely.
What kind of vehicle did you go in? There you go. I don't want to shut this thing down again. What kind of vehicle were you in that would allow you to do that?
Primarily the first responders, if they're there on site. The first responders would be the mechanics, and they'd be part of on the 88, which is, in layman's terms, the tank's tow truck. The 88 was the mechanics.
AAA.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine it like that. AAA of the tank world. They would be the first responders if they should be there on site.
Were they armored?
Yes. Not nearly as much as the Abrams, but they were good against small arms and, you know, individuals' personal firearms. As far as 50 caliber RPGs, the 88 was not so good against, but that was...
I would think the bad guys would target that. You take out an 88 and you've taken out
support. Sometimes they might see
it's
that,
like,
but
it'd be like shooting a medic.
Yeah, but they usually don't think like that. They think the thing with the gun is the big target, take that out. But thankfully, it wasn't so much the case. But, yeah, the mechanics would be going out. If they didn't have the 88, like myself, a majority of my deployment, I was on the truck convoy, where we'd have the tools, we'd have the manpower, and the ability to secure an area and safeguard it from further.
And you had the 88.
Yes.
To pick it up.
Yeah, if necessary, yes. Hopefully not too often.
Probably to change the track.
That would make it easier. We did do things like that. We'd pick up either the back half or the front half to take tension off, repair the track, take track off.
Now remember, folks, this is out in prairie country. This is out in the desert. This is not going on with asphalt driveways.
We're not going to the shop.
And how was the ground? Was it soft or?
Depends on the area you're at. A majority of it, though, was... We would call it moon dust. You would take a step, and it's just this cloud of dust would come around you, and your foot would sink in.
How deep was this dust?
That's also depending on the area, but there are some places where I'd walk around, and I wouldn't see my foot. Other places, you know, it was like walking on hard concrete, just
so what
desert.
What did this do to you as a mechanic for the tank? I'm sure that get in the machinery. Okay, go ahead. You're shaking your head.
Yep, I was going to say that it was pretty hazardous conditions for the tank itself because they just like a normal vehicle, they have an intake and an exhaust, and that intake is filtered. And after, you know, just a day, not a day or less of operating in these conditions, these filters would just become packed full of dirt, and it makes the tanks. Go ahead.
No, I was trying to get his attention. Oh. I wanted to ask you a question because the thing that I found really fascinating about the tank was that it's a turbine engine.
Yep.
It's not a reciprocal engine. It's not a car engine. It's a jet engine like we had on helicopters, like they have on jet planes.
Oh yeah.
And so anything that comes in that intake can theoretically damage the fins that are spinning to generate the energy. I like to ask it's Patrick that was the commander. How did that work? Did it work okay? I guess the filter must have worked efficiently. Pat?
It was actually called a pre-cleaner, and the pre-cleaner kind of does like it'll filter it out initially, and then that'll start to get clogged up, and then you have something called your PJAS that kicks in, and that'll kind of like help push out some of the moon dust out of the pre-cleaner. And sometimes it doesn't always work, and I actually found myself jumping on top of my pre-cleaner during convoys just to get all the moon dust out of there, and it was good times.
I'm sure it was a good time. I was just trying to figure out exactly how these things operated because you're talking about a 70-ton tank.
Thanks.
and you know the energy that it took to get it even moving, I would think would be pretty difficult. What kind of fuel efficiency did they have inside that thing? A half a mile to a gallon?
How about that?
It all kind of depends. It depends on if you're idling or if you're operating. Generally, if you're going full operation, it'll run about, I think it's 50 gallons an hour it'll consume if you're fully operational, run around and stuff.
And what's the capacity of the tank? Or the tank of the tank. There we are. The fuel tank. How many gallons does that hold?
What is it, like 500 gallons?
Oh, it's that big.
No, I think it's, for the M1A1, it's about 380 and some change.
300 gallons?
No.
That's 800.
What? Okay, Ben's coming in.
Okay.
Go ahead, Ben.
504 gallons.
No way.
Yeah, 504 gallons.
Well, at 8 pounds a gallon for liquid,
6 pounds. 6 pounds for GP4, right?
Wow.
Is it 6 pounds something per gallon somewhere in that neighborhood? So you got 3,000 pounds of fuel. That's a big bomb.
So you folks, okay, well, let's get back. I mean, this is really something. I mean, you have this is your home, right? This is it. This is a mobile moving home. Now, let's get Ben, you're the gunner, and you had extra, the Abrams had more range than the Russian tanks. Is that correct?
Yes.
You could hit the tanks before the enemy got you. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, are we talking range or are we talking loading?
Range, here? Right. They had to get closer to shoot at you. Is that true?
I believe they were roughly around the same. I want to say we could touch a little further, but.
So you had, because I often wonder when I see these programs on tanks about the guys that are, I mean, there you are, you're like show face to face, and you're, I don't know, 500 yards apart maybe, and you're dueling it out. It's just like being at the OK Corral or something, and here you are, you have that advantage though of the longer range. So how often could you, Pat, how often could you use that strategy, hit them while they're a long way away, and get yourself in position to do that? Is that true? Pat, are you there?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't know. I thought you were talking to Ben. Because you're talking about engaging, like, armored vehicles, and, you know, we never really had that experience in either theater of operations. So, I mean, we train for it, but I do not have any firsthand experience engaging vehicles. I missed the actual invasion of Iraq by like 3 months. So
now, was there such a thing for the tank to have? What should I want to say? A BB point. Was there a point tank? Somebody there in the front?
Oh yeah, it's just like I mean, you can kind of tone the scale down to just regular like a four-man fire team, and the formations are pretty much the same. So if you have a wedge formation for a platoon of tanks, I mean it's kind of the same thing. And then you can kind of branch it out to where you have three platoons of four tanks each, so 12 tanks that are in a wedge formation. And yeah, there'll be a man up, or a tank up front.
Do you, Ben? Let's get back to you, the gunner. Did you have a range finder or something that would give you distance so that would make you more accurate?
Yes, we had a laser range finder.
Laser, eh? Shot that thing right through. And then, but while you're waiting, who gives the command to fire? Is that you, the gunner, or do you wait for the commander?
No, the commander gives the command to fire.
You tell him it's ready. You tell him the ground is ready.
He'll tell me to get on a target, and I'll find the target and get on it. And when if he has to call up to the CO or somebody for permission to fire, I'll wait on him to call up. I can hear all that over the radio, and then he'll tell me to fire if I'm given permission, and then I'll just let loose.
Well, speaking of let loose, was there anything there like fire for effect? We did in the mortars once you got the range, to fire for effect. Is there something like that in the tanks once you got the range and the bad guys were all lined up out there, that you just didn't have to wait for the commander? Is that something that happened, or did you have to wait for each time you fired a shot?
Well, because the ROEs were so strict while we were over there.
Like what?
Give
me an example.
Just the rules of engagement in general.
Give me one.
Because we're not facing other tanks, because we're using tanks against people, it's not really the same thing.
To me it is.
That's a big firepower difference.
What do you think of that, Dale?
No, I was agreeing. The rules of engagement are so, seems like they're so strict this time.
Who makes them up?
Politicians mostly. I think that's the case. I mean, even, 50 years ago, the rules of engagement, that you didn't shoot into a village, you didn't, that type of thing. And so even though you were taking fire from a village, these guys, and my question to you, what kind of weapons did you have on there other than whatever size cannon it was?
Who are we directing this to?
I'm sorry, I'm directing this to Ben.
Ben.
The tank commander had a 50 cal that he had control of. The gunner had, obviously, the 120 cannon, and then also a coaxial machine gun, which is a 240 with 7.62 caliber, obviously.
Oh, okay.
And then the loader also had a mounted 7.62 240. But that was, those weren't very accurate. There was no sight on those, so It was really kind of just for suppressing fire.
Were they controlled remotely? I mean, obviously you guys didn't stick your head out if you were getting shot at, so you just kind of, did you aim them from inside the tank just through a little porthole, or were they?
For the 50 cal, for the tank commander, yes, they had a sight inside where they had a regular sight and then also a thermal sight for at night.
The
loader's 240 did not have any sight whatsoever, and it was controlled manually from the outside.
Did you guys carry sidearms?
Yes.
Oh, what did you carry? We
always had our 9mm, the Berettas, on us at all times.
I think we talked about that, didn't we, Luke? What did you have, Luke? You had the 9mm?
I did not, unfortunately.
You were out there without nothing?
Well, I had something. If we were referencing the Berettas, we were not as privileged as the tankers. I did have my M4 assault rifle, which was very nice to have. Never really had to use it though, so we didn't have issued Berettas as far as mechanics and the extremities of the tankers go.
Well, I want to get to another spot here, which I think is very interesting, that we were talking about hitting tanks and being the point tank, and and getting disabled and things. And by December of 2006, over 500 Abrams tanks were shipped back to the U.S. for repair. Let that sink in, folks. 70-ton, that's a house. That's a, you're moving up. And you're shipping that all the way back to the U.S. Dale, you were talking about helicopters.
Well, I mean, initially when the helicopters were damaged in Vietnam, they would send them back to El Paso, Texas to be repaired. And
Why didn't you repair them in Benoit?
Well, I guess because they didn't have the facilities to do that there until they brought in, they reconditioned an old, some sort of aircraft carrier, I think it was, and turned it into a repair ship just off the coast. And they built they would take the damaged ones just out to the ship. And
I think it was called the USS Sikorsky, which is now a reef outside of Florida, I do believe.
I don't know what the name of it. I wanted to know about you mentioned 500 tanks being sent back, and I Luke, you could probably ask this as the mechanic. You know, what was the major thing that would go wrong with these things?
Depending on the situation and what was going on, as far as Iraq, I don't have personal experience. That might be a good, you know, I'm sure Patrick has some good opinions about that. But if I had to guess, I would say it'd be just catastrophic damage to the hull, which is what the tank, the turret, mm-hmm. everything sits on and in. The hull is what carries that load.
Was there a lot of secret stuff?
Comprised in the tank, yes. A lot of it was need to know basis. Only the tank community knew how this thing worked. If you went from one soldier or one Marine to another, like a tanker talking to, you know, some other you know, pencil pusher in the front office, they wouldn't know what's going on inside the tank because they don't know. They don't need to know. But there was a lot of things involved with the tank, how it worked, that was classified to the public, to, I don't know, anybody, I guess, except for the mechanics and the tankers themselves.
Pat, as a commander, and you were given training to do this, I'm sure, with that, if there would be a situation that you had to abandon the tank, how would you destroy the tank?
There was actually one time in Iraq where they attempted to do that because they didn't think they'd be able to get the tank back to the FOB. And there was a very, very upset colonel that got involved and said, "You are dragging that thing back on its belly if you have to." And that's exactly what they did. So there are some ways to disable a tank. You have to take out the breech block, and there's certain ways to do that with thermal grenades or thermite grenades. And there's a few other things that go into it. I'm not exactly too savvy what the specific protocol is off the top of my head, but yeah, there's definitely ways to completely destroy a tank, but that's a very rare thing. I don't think it's ever been done in the last 15 years, or the last 12 years, I should say, of combat.
So all tanks, all Abrams were recovered. The ones that were damaged or incapacitated, they were all recovered. Is that correct?
To my knowledge with the Marine Corps, yes. I'm not sure. The Army has a lot more tanks than we do. So I don't know if the Army, because they have M1A1s as well, and M1A2s. So I'm not sure exactly if the Army recovered all theirs, but I would assume so.
Luke, you have a comment.
I would say, as far as me being a mechanic, that was if we would give it our all to get that, even if it wasn't moving, that 70-ton hunk of metal, we would give it our all to get it back to wherever we could to get it safe. That was our job, to get it back, and if we could, get it back up and running.
Okay, all three of you. I've seen in the past, World War II, etc., where they named their tanks Happy Mama, Big Bertha. What did you guys and identify yourself? Which one? Did you have a name for your tank? Anybody? The three of you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The deployment we were on, we named ours Kindness because we wanted to kill the enemy with kindness. And we named the coax on it Complacency because complacency kills, you know. So that was our name.
Luke?
I wasn't on a tank personally, but the 88 that I had been on towards the end, we titled it Redemption, because the last 88 that the crew was on, it actually went ablaze for some crazy complicated reasons that I'm not going to explain, but we got on the new 88, which is that tow truck I was talking about, and we called it Redemption.
There's a tow truck, folks, that has two booms, right, and can pick up the whole...
There is the main boom on it, which can lift up to 35 tons, and then there's a little side boom, but that doesn't do much.
And this thing can pick the whole thing up, folks. That's right.
Two of those 88s, side by side.
Oh, side. Yeah. Okay, I got it. Okay. Or one could drag it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The 88 itself.
This has got to be something to see.
The 88 itself had the ability to pull just with bars in between them. One tank, and if conditions are right, it could pull two tanks. If they were just, you know, fine, nothing wrong with them, it could pull two of those tanks.
When you were outside the FOB, Pat, did you guys have any chance to sleep? Or was it just 24/7? You all were jumping around and doing things and moving around. What about that, Pat?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you're doing, obviously, but at every minute of every hour while you're outside the wire, someone's awake, someone, like, all 360 degrees are being watched by someone. But, I mean, you get some sleep, but, I mean, no, it's not like, it's definitely, you're not sleeping on a queen-size mattress, and you're definitely worried about someone sneaking up on you and maybe slitting your throat or lobbing a grenade in your tank. So, I mean, it's not the most comfortable sleep.
Ben? We haven't heard from you in a little bit. Here you are, the gunner. What else did you do on the tank?
In regards to what?
Well, I mean, while you weren't gunning, what else was your job?
Well, I mean, if I wasn't gunning and we were back in the...
Yeah, you're moving around.
Bob, then we were fixing the tank.
No, but if you were moving around, what does the gunner do while the tank's moving and you're not aiming at anything? You're just looking around through a periscope or something?
Oh, you're always, traversing and looking through the site. I mean, you're always keeping your eyes open for anything unusual, just anything that looks out of the ordinary to make sure that you're not getting taken by surprise.
Okay, we've got 2 minutes, 120 seconds. Dale?
How much does an Abrams A1 tank cost?
On the, if we were going for the MSRP on our list, it was $2 million, brand new.
Isn't that cool, folks? Right.
That's the M1A1, not the A2, which the Army is blessed with, the newer stuff and the fancier things. The Marine Corps' M1A1 was $2 million.
Okay, we've got about a minute and a half now, and I'm real quick. Ben, you have a last comment for everybody. What do you want to say?
Oh, I'm just glad that you guys had me here. I'm glad that Luke asked me to be here, and thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Do you miss the tank?
Yes, I do.
I know, there's nothing you can do, I know. Gosh, maybe you can go somewhere and get a ride. Real quick, Pat, we got a minute. You've got about 15 seconds. Tell us what about the tank and saying goodbye and all that. Real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you guys having me on. And as far as missing tanks, I did it for 12 years. So, I mean, not really. I'm surrounded by college girls now, so it's kind of awesome. You know?
Luke, real quick.
Hey, it's a unique experience, and there's nothing else like it. Some days I do miss the whine of the turbine, and some days I really miss the sound of that twin-turbo diesel 88.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.